Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Deuteronomy 28 has some parallels that I want to mention to you before we start. This chapter naturally breaks at verse 15. Now, I couldn't do 1 through 15 tonight and then do 15 through 68 next Sunday night, so because we're going to have camp reflections next Sunday night. But anyway, it's too long a chapter to break like that. It goes through verses 1 through 68. So I have broken it totally arbitrarily at 37. And really the chapter naturally breaks into 1 through 14 blessings and 15 through 68 cursings. There are two parallels for this. Leviticus chapter 26. Stephen, right over there, need one more. Leviticus 26 has the same kind of cursing-blessing formula. And what will surprise you, I think, that King Solomon's dedicatory prayer of his temple in 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 22 through 53, follows the cursing and blessings of these two chapters. And I never had realized that, and so I think that's very interesting, that his prayer to God was along the lines of these blessings and cursings. Now, as you know, there is a real similarity between Hebrew Old Testament treaty pacts and what we've come to find archaeologically known as Hittite-Caesarian treaties. Now, that is an international treaty between the leaders of the Hittite nation, which was dominant in the days of the second millennium B.C., and other servant nations. And so striking is the parallel that we have found that many of the curses are in the exact order, almost word for word, with the curses we found in other documents. So now, the real question is, what do you do with a fact like that? How do you interpret it? Seems to me, not that someone was borrowing someone else, but there was a general social milieu of these curses that were very current. And it's just too striking to me, the parallels, not to have some kind of connection. What connection, I'm not sure. So there is a background here. Matter of fact, long for years after Schleiermacher and other ones quit, and other ones in the 18th century, 19th century, began to criticize the Old Testament as far as being Moses writing the Pentateuch. They'd say it's many authors and all that. Only in the last few years have these ancient Hittite documents showed the historicity of this type of document in its day without all these multiple authors. And I think that's significant. Let me get you to read verses 1 through 14 in your translations, which will do with the curses. There's not a whole lot of comment I can do on this. It's pretty self-explanatory. I will add some explanatory notes tonight, but not a whole lot, I'm afraid. There's just not much I can do with this kind of thing. So read 1 through 14. I'll add what I can, and then we'll go on from there. You get to smile at me. Okay. I want you to notice, first of all, the conditional element of these blessings and cursings. If with your pencils you were to circle with me just four of these things to show you the whole context, look at the if you will in verse 1, the if you will in verse 2, the if you will in verse 9, the if you will in verse 13. When we get to the cursing, it's going to say, if you will not, if you will not, if you will not. Conditional element. Now let's talk about that for a moment. For this is where probably my most incisive comment will be in this chapter. Would you agree with me that man is not free not to sin? Think about that. Would you agree with me that man is not free not to sin? In other words, man is going to sin. Man does not have a choice of sin or not sin. Man, because of the fall, is going to sin. Would you agree with me on that? If you agree with me that man is not only... and I agree man has a free will. But man's free will is not able to respond in the area of sinning and not sinning after the fall. If that be true, why does God seem to link the promises to man's ability to keep the law? Now think with me. If man can't keep the law because man can't keep from sinning, why does God's promises seem to link themselves to man's keeping the law that God knew man could not keep? Well, we're going to get New Testament for a moment. Galatians 3 informs us that the law was meant to show us two things. The law was made to show us our sinfulness, and the law was meant to lead us to Christ. Put it another way. The law was God's way of showing man that works righteousness is not the way to be right with God. But the way to be right with God is through the simple grace of God in love. No man has ever been right with God because he kept the law, that law, any law. Why then such severe penalties and such extraordinary blessings attached to a set of rules? Simply to say, God's blessings were not conditional on man's response. But the covenant was conditional as far as man was concerned. That's very confusing. Now I'm going to try to put it in a little... The if you will, I will formula, the whole Old Testament, is not an attempt to say, you come across and I'll bless you, God says. You do what I say and I'll bless you, because God knew man could not do what God said do. Therefore, the blessings are not merits for keeping the law, but the blessings are undeserved grace gifts from God, but to be received, must be received by faith. Now, what about the cursings? The same thing's got to be true. It has amazed me as I've gone through this chapter that a reoccurrent theme as long, with a conditional element is, you are going to be an example to all the nations. You see, the place of the Jews is a very unique and problematic place. Why did God choose them? Because they're such a great, good people? No, the book of Deuteronomy says, because they had no country, because they were a stiff-necked, rebellious people, that God could take this group that no one could see to love, that had no land, and bestow his undeserved blessing on a people like this to show the world God's kind of love, and then to be faithful in the midst of their idolatry and their rebellion and their apostasy down through the years, for God to remain faithful when the Jewish people remained unfaithful. Now, there's periods of faithfulness and periods of prosperity, but the general rule of the Hebrew history is rebellion and stiff-neckedness and unbelief and apostasy is the rule. Even the leaders, even the great leaders of the country have been great sinners. But God has used this to show the world that when he makes a promise, he keeps a promise. Notice, if you would, verse 12. Verse 10. So that all the peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they shall... Now, the word should not be afraid of you. The same thing, we don't talk about being afraid of God. We talk about reverencing God. The same word used here. They would reverence the nation of Israel. Look at verse 25, last part. And you shall be an example of terror to all the kingdoms of the earth. And look at verse 37. And ye shall become a horror, a proverb, and a taunt among all the people where the Lord will drive you. Israel is an example to the world. An example of what? Of this paradoxical relationship of God and man. Every time God comes to man, God says, if you will, I will. Every time. You say, not the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant is based on the words, if you will leave your kindred and come out of Ur of the Chaldees and follow me to a land that I'll show you, I'll be your God. In my opinion, every promise of God is conditional. Look at the New Testament. The free, undeserved, unmerited grace of God in Jesus Christ. Is it conditional? You bet your bippy it's conditional. It's conditional on faith response to Jesus Christ. But at the same time it's conditional from man's response, God, to those who at least attempt to respond in faith, it is unconditional. That's why we're not saved or lost by keeping the law or being a good Christian or coming to church or keeping the rules or not sinning. We are saved because of the faithfulness of God to His promise, if you will confess me, I will be your God. Now that is this paradox relationship between conditional on man's part, unconditional on God's part. The Jewish nation is an example for us of unbelief and God's mercy in the midst of unbelief. Now, I'll give you the side B to that. How are the Jews going to be won back to Christ? In jealousy over God's love for the Gentiles. Is that right? Romans 9 to 11. They're going to see God's blessing of us, though undeserved, and out of the natural olive tree. They're going to see that God has incorporated us and blessed us. And Paul says that the Jew will be won by jealousy toward the Gentile. God is using us in the same way that God used them, except in a little different twist. So the Jew are the chosen people, not for greatness, but for an example of God's undeserved love amidst rebellion. Think about that. I think that's very significant as far as Old Testament theology goes. And I think it'll help you. Now, notice if you would, in verse 3, it says, you shall be in the city, blessings in the city and blessings in the country. Here we have the urban life and the rural life, and you know how different those are. Reminds me of my ignorance about the farmer, about the peanut seed, you know. To a city boy, that's a good question. To a farmer, that was dumb. And I think sometimes we don't, you know, city people have a very hard time communicating to country people sometimes. And vice versa, because of the radical difference of upbringing and perspectives and lifestyle. The blessing is going to be universal in all segments of Israeli Hebrew society. Notice it speaks in verse 4, the blessings of children, the blessings of herds, the blessings of cattle. Notice that cattle and children are a sign of wealth, right? A man with a large family was blessed by God. A man with large flocks is blessed by God. Now, these were kind of physical signs of the blessings of God, and therefore they're included in this. Notice verse 5 where it says, "And blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl." The word basket here is used in Deuteronomy 26:2 for the basket that the Jews were to take their tithe to the temple. Knowing the Old Testament, it was a big basket for the... The priest will never let a little basket be carried, so it must have been a very deep basket. It's also often used to carry fruits from the vineyard or carry grain, so it's a large basket. And it speaks of prosperity in agriculture. The kneading trough is a bowl that women use to grind grain and prepare family meals. It's a way of saying there'll always be food on your table. There'll be plenty, and there'll be food on your table. Notice it says a little phrase that's customary of the Old Testament. Blessed you shall be when you come in, and blessed you shall be when you go out. That's a Hebraic idiom for a blessed life altogether. It's speaking of the affairs of life, the work of life, your hands. It's a way of saying God will bless all that you do. You're coming in, you're going out, okay? Notice in verse 7 it says something about your enemy shall flee seven ways. He'll come one way, he'll flee seven ways. What's that talking about? Well, look at verse 25. The table's turned now. We're in the cursing section, and it talks about Israel doing that. Talking about coming up as a united army, but in the panic of the moment, fleeing every possible direction. Terror has taken over the army, and they just run wildly. And, of course, the number seven, being a perfect number, is the symbol of running every which way. Okay? Notice, if you would, in verse 8, where it says, "Blessing be upon your barns." In Proverbs 3:10, this word is used to imply grain barns. We would probably call them silos in our culture and society. The rabbis had an interesting interpretation of this. The Hebrew word for barns and the Aramaic word for conceal are very, very close. And so the rabbis, using their system of hermeneutics, which we don't use, but anyway, their system of hermeneutics would say that they're synonymous. And so the rabbis would say this is a verse that says, what you do, how God blesses you, He'll bless you in secret. Because if your neighbor knew how much God was blessing you, your neighbor might be jealous and put the evil eye on you. So to save you from the evil eye, God will bless you in your barns in secret. New Testament would be, don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing, kind of thing. And so I think that's just pure baloney, but I thought it was interesting. Notice verse 9 where it says, you shall be a holy people. What does it mean, a holy people? Does holy mean that they'll be morally upright? Theologically correct? Does the history of Israel show them to be a theologically holy people? How about a morally upright people? What does the word holy mean? It means set apart. That's what the word means. When used in connection with God, it means set apart for God's service. Again, Exodus chapter 19, verses 5 and 6, that very beautiful passage that you shall be a peculiar people, a special treasure among all the world, for all the peoples of the world are mine. God is going to use the Jews in a wonderful way to impress the heathen nations of His grace and love. So that is what the context of holy people is. They are going to be a kingdom of priests. Their business would be to bring the nations to God. In the past, I have interpreted this to say that Israel turned in and did not do what God wanted to be. That God wanted to be a kingdom of priests, and therefore they didn't do it, and God punished them. I have totally changed my position on that. I believe they did exactly what God knew they were going to do, for the very fact that God chose them to be a holy people was to show His faithfulness amidst rebellion. So I think God knew all along they would turn in, but that the nations were, and are today, a God, that the Jewish nation is still a nation, and that God is still honoring His promises in the midst of what we would consider great unbelief in Jesus. God will use that some way. Notice in verse 10, I've already mentioned that, I think, CF verse 25 and verse 37. Verse 11 is very repetitive. You may have read this and said, why do they repeat themselves so much? Some of you will think it's different authors. Baloney. You read Semitic languages or Semitic literature, the thing that will impress you the most is, why do these people repeat so much? It is a characteristic of Semitic languages to repeat large sections over and over and over. English has some great idiosyncrasies that no other language has. This is a Hebrew idiosyncrasy, and it's all through your Old Testament. Notice, if you would, please, in verse 12, where it mentions that God will open His good storehouse, the heavens, to give rain to your land. There is two possibilities here. Speaking of Malachi, remember the phrase in Malachi that says, and God will open the windows of heaven and pour a blessing on you that you will not be able to receive? The idea about the blessings, the heavens containing a blessing. And of course, the Jewish thought was there were seven heavens, and one of them contained all the hail and rain and wind, and God left that down at appropriate times to furnish the earth. We have found some very unusual legends in the Near East. Legends about the fertility god Baal, which is the Hebrew word for master or lord. And he is spoken of as having built his house in the heavens and have building it with little things you build in the roof nowadays. Skylights to let out blessings. I wouldn't put it past Moses to put a little gig in Baal's wagon, to tell the truth, and mention this to say to them, Baal ain't the one, even legends or not, about his storehouse that gives the rain. Yahweh gives the rain. I, I just kind of think Moses is going right back in the teeth of the fertility cup, the very words they used to describe their God, and yet he's putting it to Yahweh and not to Baal. I can't prove that a whole lot, but I think that's what he's doing. Rain to a desert people is worth more than gold. A desert with rain will bring forth produce like it's unbelievable. Sand can be very, very productive if it has rain. And so God's greatest gift to the land of Israel, any land of the desert, is rain. And notice that God and nature are not separate. It's not these little commercials that talk about Mother Nature and Father Nature. Yuck. God and nature are different, though God is in control of nature. Notice verse 14, and I want to ask you a question. I hope you can answer this. Verse 14 relates to a category of Hebrew words that I've talked about many, many times. Turning to the right or to the left is a way of talking about something in Hebrew theology. Do you remember what I've talked to you about turning to the right or the left or turning away or being crooked? Crooked is what word in Hebrew? Crooked. Sin. Missing the mark, crookedness, perversity. All those Hebrew words for sin talk about a deviation from the standard. So this idea about turning to the right or the left, I think God's saying, don't do more than I told you. Don't do less than I told you. Just do what I told you. For any deviation from the standard is sin, be it positive or negative. Do you hear me, Baptist? Reading too much in is just as much as sin as leaving something out. Now, verse 15 down through 37 is only a portion of the cursings. There have been great problems among commentators for the 14 verses for blessings and the rest for cursing. What's God mad? We have found archaeologically in these Hittite Caesarian treaties that an abnormal amount of verses is given to the cursings. You think even these pagan kings understand something of human nature? And you say, well, should I take these literally? It's a hard word for me to define. I don't know what literally means. If you mean, should I take them the way they seem to, what they're trying to convey, then yes. Do you mean that if one Israelite sins, that God's going to axe the whole country completely? This passage is almost a prophetic insight into the history of Israel as far as the exile and the rest. But what we're trying to do here is build up an impression of disaster. Was every woman carried off? Was every child killed? Was every plant blighted? No. No. So if you mean by literally that every plant had blight, then I reject that interpretation. But if you mean that these kind of characteristics will follow if you do these kind of things, then yes. It is a Semitic way of building up a great preponderance of what's going to happen to you if you break God's law. And in that sense, it conveys accurately and truly what I think the Hebrew author was trying to convey, which is the seriousness of rebellion. Now, and you'll see what I mean when we go through here, okay? The easiest way, again, I think, instead of me reading this, is for you to read 15 through 37. And as you read it in your translation, you have somebody next to you to bring your Bible up and read on with you. And think of questions now, for there will be great questions, I think, in this section. Wow. That's worse than falling down a Roman theater, Phil. I wonder. In my younger days of trying to get people to read the Old Testament, I used to ask them, have you read the Old Testament? I said, yeah. I said, do you remember the golden mice and the hemorrhoids? And they look at me like, I beg your pardon. Do you remember in the Old Testament where there were golden mice and golden hemorrhoids? Do you? Okay. We'll try to get as far as you've read. I know it's a little repetitive again. You notice how repetitive it is. Matter of fact, the cursings are going to parallel the blessings to some extent. Notice in let's look at verse 15 first. You see the word that all these curses shall come upon you to overtake you? See the word curses there? That's a noun form, right? Starting in verse 16, from then on, it's a verb form. You shall be cursed by God, the implication. Now, the noun come, the Hebrew, this is one problem of translation of any language into another. There's two different roots here. The noun, cursed, comes from a root that means to be small. I talked to you last week about the Hebrew psychology related to smallness. When David says, he plant my feet on a wide and spacious land. Man, to a Hebrew, that's great. Hebrews would live very well in Lubbock. They like the wide open spaces, you see. To be small, enclosed, to be in a cave, to be in the woods, to be in a small room, was, in a sense, a metaphorical way of a curse. And so the noun, to curse, is from the verb to be small. Now the verb form of the word curse is from a noun that means to bind, to tie, to fetter. And so in English, you just got the word curse, but in Hebrew, you got two different words with two different philological backgrounds and understandings, which is very true in all languages, and why it's so hard sometimes to understand the English Bible. Let's look at verse 16 and 19 parallel completely verses 3 through 6, except 16 through 19 is the curses and 3 through 6 is the blessings. Notice in verse 20 it speaks about, and I will send upon you curses, confusion, rebuke. Now the word confusion is a word that's used of battle. Remember how God confused the armies of Israel's enemies? One time he sent the hornets out. One time he struck them blind. One time Gideon polished his swords and held candles in front of him, and the light scared the other army to retreat. Remember when David killed Goliath and the armies, just confusion and fear struck in and panic. He started running and the Israelites killed an army five times bigger than him. Well, what God's saying, if you don't obey my words, the confusion will be on you, O Israel. And notice it says in verse 20 some very, in my opinion, some very strong things to Israel. If you disobey my commandments, this is going to happen to you until you're destroyed, until you perish quickly. Matter of fact, look at down in verse 22, until you perish. And all the way through here, God says, if you don't, I will destroy you. I'm not going to smack your hand. I'm going to take you out. Serious deal. You know, I'm not going to kill your king. I'm going to kill a whole bunch of you. So please, don't think God is a respecter of persons. He did and promised to do to Israel the same thing he did and promised to do to the Amorites. And I wonder sometime how our country will fare. Notice down in verse 22. Some think that verses 22 through 24 are a metaphor of trying to describe the eastern winds. I think they're called the Sirocco winds that blow off the desert. And when these winds come, they destroy crops completely. The cattle dehydrate. Children that dehydrate. It's a very serious thing when these eastern, hot, totally humidless winds come across the desert. And I don't know if I can buy that. It seems there's more involved here than just the wind, because it talks about consumption and fever and inflammation and fiery heat. Nobody knows what all these Hebrew medical terms mean. Well, I read stuff that's obviously bubonic plague, that's obviously leprosy, that's obviously elephantitis. It's obvious that we don't know what it means. Now, it communicated something to the Hebrews, but we don't have no idea what those different diseases are. But notice they're all involved with heat, fever. Something burning is involved in this. Now, the word sword in my translation, see, with fiery heat and with sword and with blight and with mildew, there comes a change in that verse from diseases on man to diseases on crop. The Hebrew word for sword and the Hebrew word for drought are very, very close. The Vulgate, the Arabic, and the Samaritan text of the Old Testament have the word drought. The Masoretic text has the word sword. I usually follow the Masoretic text because it proved to be the best text since we found the Dead Sea Scrolls. But I think in this one occurrence, I'm going to take the one vowel modification and make it drought, because it seems to fit much more in the context than the word sword, although it's very possible to see the word sword here also. Notice it talks about verse 24. Listen, you Lubbockites, to the word of the Lord. The Lord will make the rain of your land powder and dust, and from heaven it shall come down upon you until you are destroyed. Friend, ain't nothing but a good old West Texas dust storm, what that's talking about. And I haven't been here to have some, but I've heard people tell me that years ago, I had a preacher, Ray Summers from Bader, tell me he came to preach at First Baptist Church, oh, back in the 40s, I guess. And they put him in a motel downtown at First Baptist Church right across the street, and said dust storm came and he couldn't even see the church. Mercy. That's a dust storm. And they used to have some bad ones around here. That's the same kind of thing. Dust so bad that chokes you. So you know something about what that's talking about. Notice verse 26, a very scary verse to a Hebrew. And your carcasses shall be food for all the birds of the sky and the beasts of the earth, and there shall be no one to frighten them away. Semitic people were terribly afraid of being unburied. This dichotomy between body, soul, and spirit, in my opinion, is platonic and not biblical. I do not think that man is a trichotomy of body, soul, and spirit. I think man is a unity. The Hebrew scripture says, God formed man out of the dust of the earth, breathed in his nostrils the breath of life, and he didn't have a soul, he became a soul. Now, I think we can divide that up some. The Bible uses those metaphors to speak about the different parts of man as they relate to our environment or to God. But man is a unity. And for the Hebrew to have his body picked by birds and his body torn by wild beasts was the height of tragedy. And so, because you see, the Hebrews and the Christians are the only people in all the world that believe that the body is an absolutely necessary part of the future. We don't believe like the Greek religions do that our body is a prison house of the soul, and when we die, our spirit goes back to God and is free. We believe that when we are with God, we will have a bodily expression. Now, what it's going to be like, I don't know. But we're going to have a body. And over again, the resurrection says we are going to have a body. And so, to a Hebrew, it was tragedy. Now, you know the older parts of the Old Testament did not see clearly the resurrection of the dead. We find some in Daniel. We find some in some of the Psalms. Maybe the book of Job, I think, has some beautiful picture of the resurrection. But general Old Testament theology does not have the resurrection. It has God's blessing in this life, and it's carried on the lives of your children. And a man goes to where? Goes to Sheol, a very shadowy existence. And this prospect of having your body torn apart by wild beasts bothered them in their concept of the afterlife. Also, this thing is used eschatologically a lot, or used about the end time. There are many predictions in the Old Testament, as well as the New, that speak about the gathering of vultures and the birds of prey, picking the bodies of people and all. So it's a very common expression in the Semitic, especially Hebrew, background. Well, look at verse... Well, by the way, let me mention something else. 1 Samuel 17, verses 44 through 46. David and Goliath square off, and Goliath says, "You little runt, you, how dare they send a kid out to fight me? I'm going to take your body and what? Feed it to the birds." And David, being the kind young Jewish boy that he is, says, "Yeah, I'm going to do the same to you, big one." So they both, that's the worst curse they could think about. "I'm going to let the birds eat you." And that's a historical example of that. Notice verse 27. The boils of Egypt, in my opinion, refer not to a common disease of Egypt, but to the things the Hebrews saw there, the plague of the boils, in Exodus chapter 9, verses 8 and following. Who knows where the hemorrhoids are mentioned in the Old Testament besides here? Well, one of the places they're mentioned. Anybody? Where, Peggy? Remember when Eli's kids were worthless kids anyway? He didn't train them right. And they wanted to go to battle and took the Ark of the Covenant with them. It was common, but they lost the battle to the Philistines. The Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant, took it and put it in the temple of their god. And next morning they came back and their god was falling down face first in front of the Ark. And suddenly the whole town of the Philistines was... The Lord sent a plague of mice everywhere, and a plague of hemorrhoids. Now, I don't know what could be worse than having mice in your house and hemorrhoids too, but that's where they had it. So the Philistines made little gold mice and little gold hemorrhoids and put those in the Ark of the Covenant and sent the Ark of the Covenant back to Israel. And if you want to read about that, it's 1 Samuel chapter 5, verse 6, when you get home. The word itch here is a word that is often translated in Hebrew, sun, S-U-N. So I don't know how they got itch. This Hebrew word, we don't know what it means, and it's translated radically different ways, and itch seems to be the best here. I don't know what in the world it is, but anyway, it's close enough here you can see what's happening. Notice verse 30, which is... remember we went to Deuteronomy 20, and we talked about some exemptions from military service. If you built a new house and hadn't lived in it, if you took a wife and you hadn't had a chance to be with her and raise up inheritance, and if you... planted a tree and hadn't eaten of the produce, something like that? Notice verse 30 is the curse on those exemptions. What it's trying to say is in that day, there won't be any exemptions. Every man you've got will be in the army and every one of them will fall. So verse 30 parallels Deuteronomy 20, 5 through 7. Mentioned verse 35. As you know, I'm just hop-skipping through here. This is just... These are almost self-explanatory. Notice verse 35 says, from the sole of your foot to the crown of your head. Where have you heard that before? Job, chapter 2, verse 7. That's what happened to Job, same kind of thing. Notice where it says, your king, in verse 36. What is so unusual about the word your king appearing in Deuteronomy? Excuse me? And they haven't had a king and had no thought about having a king. One other time, in Deuteronomy, Moses mentions a king one other time. But this is way away from the monarchical period. That's why folks say, well, this was written in the time of Josiah. I'm not so. I think Moses recognized there'd be a king someday. And so it says, your king whom set over you. Notice it says, a nation which neither you knew nor your fathers have known is going to do these kinds of things to you. That means it can't be Egypt, right? Right. Who is referring to? This is a prophetic reference to the exile under the Assyrians and later the Babylonians. So people who don't believe in predictive prophecy say this couldn't have been written in Moses' day. It had to be written in the days that it was accomplished historically, and therefore it's written much, much later. Well, I happen to have no problems at all with predictive prophecy. I think that God is able to tell the future and does it all to Jesus, you know, the same thing. And so I think what we have here is a predictive element that shows me the Bible is supernatural. It doesn't have anything to do with dates or someone writing history after the fact. If a guy claims to write in the name of Moses and says he knows something before it happens, and really it's a guy who's not Moses writing later down the years, that's just a flat lie to me, and there ain't no lies in God's book. I know I'm narrow, but you have to deal with that. Verse 37, again, is a very interesting verse. The Hebrews are going to be a proverb to the people, a mescal, a teaching implement to the people. It'll be a teaching instrument of horror and awestruckness, but it will be a teaching instrument. And God will use even their rebellion to His glory. Okay, I've hit some pretty deep theological things. This thing about conditional, unconditional is pretty heavy. This thing about God's people being rebellious is pretty heavy, I know that. And this idea about the cursings here. So I'll take questions for a little while about this. Yes, Edwina. Okay, good. Yeah. That's what they think. Or sun cancers even, maybe? I don't think... We get sunburned here pretty bad. But if you ever wonder why the Arabs wear so many clothes, they wear those long robes, those big headdress. Why is that? Because that sun will take the fluid right out of you. And it, talk about a burn, it will just kill you. So, yeah, I think that might be... I didn't think of that. That's very good. Thank you. Yes? No, when you sweat and you keep it in the shade, the long clothes keeps you cooler. As funny as that is. Yeah? It was amazing in the desert when we were in Israel that the difference between the temperature in the sun and the temperature in any kind of shade, be it a rock or a little tree or a bush, was what would feel 50 degrees different? 60 degrees different. Think about that. 60 degrees different. Here's the sun beating down, and here's the shade, and they'll be 60 degrees different within a foot of each other. And that's the kind of sun. That booger would dry apricots quick, wouldn't it? Okay. Yes. Yes. Okay. We read it for you in mind. And the heaven which is over you, over your head, shall be bronze, and the earth which is under you shall be iron. Does that sound like yours? What does it say? Okay. Well, I think King James has been influenced some by Leviticus 26:19, where a similar thing is said. It's just saying there will be no rain. Zero rain. I don't want to get real off on something else, but you know, one of the passages that grabbed me in the New Testament, just grabbed my heart, is in Peter. When Peter says these false teachers are like rain clouds that come in the midst of a drought, and they look so promising and full of, man, full of what, just what you need, but the sun comes out and they're gone. So, you know, I think that relates. There may be a lot of clouds, but there'll be no rain and no dew. You see, for long months in Israel, there's no rain. Rains come in the winter. But the crops grow by means of the dew. And when it says there'll be no, the heavens will be brass or iron, whatever, that means no dew either. There'll be no moisture, dew or rain. And the crops will fail. Yes, Tommy? Mm-hmm. I think it fits exactly. Matter of fact, there are some promises in the Old Testament. Well, example, Jonah going to Nineveh. God didn't say, if they repent, I'll save them. God just told Jonah, go and tell them 40 days, I'm cutting your lights out. Even though it wasn't explicit in the preaching of Jonah, it was implicit in God's words, because when they did repent, he did relent. So there was an if then relationship, even when it wasn't verbally expressed. I have really come to think that all promises are conditional and all promises are unconditional. I know that sounds terribly paradoxical. The condition is related to the individual or to the tribe or the nation. We don't understand individual more in New Testament sense. And the unconditional is that God is going to keep his promise to whoever fulfills the condition, even if they really don't fulfill it, but attempt to fulfill it. God will keep his promise. And you know, that is the only reason that we have assurance in our salvation, is that God is faithful when we are unfaithful, isn't it? Man, deliver me from God giving me what I deserve. I want no part of justice. Give me none of justice. Give me mercy. For no one can stand before justice. No one. Any other comments? Okay, please read the rest of the cursings. I know they're... And I'm sorry, this kind of thing does not lend itself to grammatical exegesis, because there's just no way to get back into the history and try to apply it and all that. It's just short, pithy curses. And it'll be the same through the rest of this chapter, and then we'll be out of that kind of thing. So.